seems hardly to fit through. Twice I am knocked off the sled and scramble back on. Then we climb up a frozen riverbed and waterfall in the dark. The dogs jump up from boulder to boulder, and I hang beneath the sled at one point with my feet out in the open space, and suddenly we come into the burn. We were warned about the burn. It is a 92-mile-wide stretch of broken country where a forest fire took everything out. For some reason, there is often not very much snow in the burn, and this year is no exception. Just as it gets dark, I look out across a vast expanse of rocks and dirt and dead grass and burned trees falling across one another, and no snow, not a flake, as far as I can see. The dogs are still fresh, having slept a full day, and they don't care that there is no snow left for the sled runners. It's all the same to them, and I have to run them. Inside a half a mile, I'm in trouble. The dogs run beneath a burned tree, and the sled jams. I cannot back them up, so I take a small bow saw and cut through the tree, which allows the sled to escape. I barely grab on as it explodes forward to the next tree. And the sled jams, and I cut through the tree again. All through the dark night, we slam from tree to tree, with me dragging at my face half the time, bouncing off rocks and dirt, while the dogs, resting each time I must cut a tree, stay fresh and powerful and lunging. It is chaos. I have not rested well, and the hallucinations start about midnight, and I have the same man in the trench coat on the sled for a time talking to me about educational grants until I tell him to shut up and leave, and he becomes indignant. I learned that night how powerful hallucinations can be. In a rare moment, when the sled is on smooth ground, I come across a clearing and a dog team is stopped ahead of me. All the dogs are asleep, spread out across the grass, and one of the other mushers in the race is leaning over the empty sled with his fist raised. "Get out of the sled or I'll kill you," he's saying. And when I stop in back of him and ask him what is wrong, he points down to the empty sled. "It's this man. I've carried him over 200 miles, and he won't help push up the hills. I'm sick of him. I'm going to leave him here in the burn." We talk for a bit, and he relaxes and realizes he is hallucinating. But as I leave, I hear him say loudly again, "Get out of the sled." And I think as we go that perhaps it is not real, and I am hallucinating about a man having hallucinations, and that in turn triggers the thought that perhaps all of it, the burn, the race, the dogs, my life, all of it in the whole world is just hallucination. My brain is running wild with this thought when the dogs stop and I look up and there is an enormous bull buffalo standing in front of my leader, smelling his head. I stare at it for a long time. The man in the trench coat is back on my sled and the buffalo is standing there. My befuddled brain simply thinks it's another hallucination and I wait for it to disappear. It doesn't. I try to hush the man on the sled because I am worried he will anger the buffalo. I have never seen an angry buffalo, even in hallucination, and do not want to start now. The buffalo seems as big as a house, but it slowly seeps into my thinking like mud warming that the dogs would not have stopped from my hallucination. It is a real buffalo. There is a herd of real buffalo in the burn, and this bull stands looking down at my leader, Wilson, who is very sweet and a wonderful dog but dumber than a walnut, smelling him. I call the dogs up, and they go around the bull, and I am surprised when the man on the sled says nothing as we pass not 4 feet from the buffalo and could easily touch it. The buffalo does nothing to us, is very mellow. I hear later that another musher fell asleep in the burn next to his sled. His dogs were resting. And when he woke up, the buffalo was standing over him, straddling him, smelling the breath as it came out of his nostrils. "Buffalo," he says when he tells of it. There is strangely no fear in his voice. "Have very bad breath." The burn finally becomes too much. I'm going across a large clearing several miles across, and it starts to snow, and the wind kicks up until I cannot see the dogs, only the front end of the sled now and then, and I have no idea where the trail is supposed to be. Wilson loses his way and begins to wander. Since there is no trail to follow, he works around in a large circle to the right and heads off into the bush, and I don't know anything of this until we come into a box canyon and cannot proceed any farther, and I know we have lost the trail. We have run perhaps 30 or 40 miles off the trail, and to compound the problem, the wind and driving snow have quickly covered our tracks so we cannot easily find our way back, and I cannot think, cannot begin to think. I sink down on my knees next to the sled in a kind of surrender, and when I look up, my friend is there. The Eskimo man who helped me when I was sick is there, and he takes Wilson by the back of his harness and drags the team around, and I stand on the sled and we start. I do not know where we are going, but I have great confidence in the man with curving shoulders and gentle smile, and think that if we move slowly, just keep moving, he will not let me down. Hours pass, and each time I hesitate, he shows up next to the team and waves me on. I keep going, against the wind and snow, until I look down and see sled tracks. They are filling fast, so they must be very fresh. I call the dogs to increase speed, and we run through the rest of darkness, and at dawn I see a cabin which signals the end of the burn. I wish I could thank the man who saved me again, but he is gone. It is the end of day 6. Day 7. In and out of a checkpoint, a village named Nikolai. It is very crowded with snowmobiles roaring by and resting teams all around, so I don't stay. The wind stops and the sun comes out. Everything again is steeped in beauty as I run down a river and over some large hills, and we come around a corner in the brush, run up a river, and there is a bar. In the middle of nowhere, a man suddenly appears and asks me if I want a beer. I say, no, I don't drink, and he gives me a soda instead. It tastes incredibly wonderful, and I drink it down in one long swallow. While I am turned away, he throws three more sodas in my sled. It is a very nice thing to do, except that I don't see him do it, and leave the checkpoint without knowing the sodas are there. They settle down on top of the booties in my booty sack, and that night it gets 40 or 50 below, and the cans of soda freeze and burst. The next day it gets warm again. The sodas thaw and run into the cloth booties and refreeze in the cloth. Later that day, Wilson cuts his foot, and I go to get a booty for him and find they are frozen in soda slush. I thaw one in my armpit and put it on his foot, and we start off. Wilson smells the soda. If it smells interesting, he thinks, it must taste good. Soon he is running on three legs, sucking on his foot, and that's the way I pass a team, which is resting, with my leader running on three legs, sucking a foot. The musher just nods and watches Wilson run by. We run all day on a beautiful trail, down some long, long hills into a checkpoint where a beautiful blonde girl hands me a cup of hot chocolate. It is not possible for anything to taste as good as that hot chocolate tastes, and I drink it slowly, trying to make it last. I leave the checkpoint in the dark. The land is flattened into long hills like ocean swells, and the wind has died down, and the team runs well through the night while I stand on the back, lost in hallucinations again. This time I see crowds of people cheering for me. Some of them are riding snowmobiles, and some come out of cabins to wave, and I can see their families inside the cabin sitting at tables, and twice I have to move quickly on the sled to keep from being nudged by the snowmobiles when they come close to wave at me. None of it is real. Dawn comes, and we are in the interior of Alaska. So different, it is like another planet. No trees, only tundra, and the long low hills and the jingle of the dogs' collars and the woofing of their breath as they trot, and we cover the miles, the long miles, across the interior, over to the Yukon River. It is the end of day 7. Day 8. It must be the same as going to the moon, crossing the interior of Alaska by dog team. After a time it seems the team isn't moving, that the country, the tundra, the endless grass and shallow snow are rolling by beneath us, and we're standing still. So unchanging is the country. Flat, gently rolling, it is stultifying. Running through the night to get to the cabin, Wilson has started to do a new thing. He falls over. When it first happened, I was worried that something was wrong and ran forward to attend him. I put him on his feet, and his tail wagged, and he was all right, and we took off. In 30 yards, he fell over again. Once more, I put him on his feet, and we set out, and over he goes. Finally, I realize that the boredom is too much, and he is falling asleep while running. I pet him and sit next to him for a time, but he won't sleep to rest, only while we run. So he isn't tired, just bored, and once more we set off. I watch him with my light, and when his back starts to weave a bit, I say softly, "Willie." And he awakens and is fine for 40 or so yards. Then he does it again, and I say it once more, and through that long night, every 40 yards, I say, "Willie," and it works. We keep moving, and everybody stays happy. During the night, I pass teams, and they pass me. Finally, in the morning, the team stops at a small, caved-in cabin. It is not a checkpoint, but a good place to rest the dogs. Inside the cabin, a man I passed and who passed me later has a fire going in the stove. So I hang my clothes to dry and make tea. We are sitting and drinking when he asked me if I ran all night. "Yeah." "Twice somebody went past me in the dark," he said, "looking for somebody named Willie. I wonder who that was." I shrugged. I have no idea. This man had seen me running while Wilson sucked his foot. I thought there was no sense in making it worse. And that ended day 8. Day 9. We passed through the ghost town of Iditarod, which is set up as a checkpoint. I pulled the team up alongside the river to rest them under some overhanging willows. The dogs and I are sitting by a fire when a plane lands right next to me and a man gets out. "Somebody told me you had big dogs," he says, looking at my team. "I guess so. Big and slow. I have a female wolf in the plane and want to breed her to some big dogs." I look at the plane more closely, and sure enough, in the back seat is a wolf. She is huge, well over 100 pounds, and has a muzzle on. I cannot believe this man has flown out here with a wolf sitting in the back of him in an airplane just to get her bred by my dogs. "She's in season," he offers. "The only problem is she's killed 3 male dogs I tried to breed her to." "I'll pass," I say, and he shrugs amiably, jumps in the plane, and takes off. It is all so bizarre, I think perhaps I dreamt it, but there are the ski marks in the snow from the landing gear of the plane. We leave again at night. There are some mean hills as we leave, and they are dotted with gear dropped by rookies trying to get lighter. I see an extra pair of socks, some gloves, brass snaps, a Coleman stove, a good fur hat, which I try to grab but miss and don't want to stop for, several articles of undergarments. It seems a waste, but I find later that people from the checkpoint will come out with snowmobiles and harvest the hills as they do each year. 3 days earlier, one of my dogs had stopped eating any of the meats I had sent for the dogs, pork, lamb, beef, liver, and dried dog food, but she would eat the meat patties I had sent for myself, which had cheese and raisins and fat mixed in. So I gave her all my own food, and consequently didn't have any food at the checkpoints. Other mushers had helped me some, but a major food chain had butter and dry beverage powder at all the checkpoints as a promotional stunt. So when I left a checkpoint, I'd take 4 or 5 pounds of butter with me. I was eating sticks of butter as I went across the interior to maintain energy. As might be imagined, I became truly sick of butter. Don't like it much yet, and when I got to the Shagaluk checkpoint, I was glad to find that the children from the school had a huge pot of moose chili cooking in the council hall just for the mushers. It tasted wonderful, and I could not stop eating it. Like a wolf, I gorged, ate 19 paper bowls full of chili. I then started the run up the Yukon River, and inside of 4 hours I thought I was going to die of gastric distress. At one point it became so bad that the team stopped and looked back at me in surprise. End of day 9. Day 10. The run up the Yukon River is horrific. 180 miles straight north into the wind, up the middle of the great river that historically is a highway across Alaska. In the summer, barges bring supplies up the river to the villages. Now snowmobiles whiz by frequently as people go from one village to the next to visit. All the cold air in Alaska seems to settle into the Yukon Valley, and in the night it hits like a hammer blow. 40, 50 below and colder, going up the middle of the river in the deep cold night is like going inside an iceberg. I cannot stand the wind. I turn backward on the sled and hook my elbows and ride, but it is still too cold. I put on all my extra clothes and it is still too cold. I feel the cold cutting through all the clothing. I go up to check the dogs, but they are all right. No signs of frostbite, so we continue. There's nowhere to stop, at any rate. Just ice, flat ice and wind. We fight north the whole day and through the night and stop to rest in the morning at dawn, around and back of an island to get out of the wind, the cursed, cutting, tearing, soul-cold wind. I sit on the sled with my back to the wind and let the new sun warm my face, and it is the end of day 10. Day 11. Another long day, and into the night, and the bone-chilling cold. This terrible night I get too cold. The cold is coming down on me like a death, and I must run to keep my body temperature up. I run 50 paces and ride 50 and run 50 and ride 50 the whole night, and the running brings my body heat back up. But I cannot get enough air through my 2 wool masks, so I pull them down and breathe straight into my mouth. I get enough air then, but the raw, cold air freezes the sides of my throat and blood vessels burst, and my throat generates mucus, and soon I am choking on it. It is very hard to clear. I must stick a finger down my throat to help pull it out, and when I throw it on the ice, the wheel dogs turn around and eat it. This makes me throw up and eat that as well, and I spend the whole day and night running up the river, hacking blood and mucus and vomiting and hallucinating. When I approach the village that is the last checkpoint on the Yukon River, I look up at some cliffs on the left side of the river and see a bunch of crosses. We have been told about the graveyard to the south of town, and I feel the ghosts of all the dead in the graveyard welcoming me to the end of the river rim. It is a warm feeling, a gentle calling. I nod to them and smile and turn off the river on the Overland Trail out to the Bering Sea. It is the end of the river and the end of day 11. Day 12. There is a change on this day, in the dogs and in me. We run down from the river out to the Bering Sea on a classic run. It is about zero or slightly above, and there is sun and it is downhill for over 90 miles and the dogs run to my mind. I have changed. Have moved back in time, have entered an altered state, a primitive state. At one point there is a long uphill grade, over a mile, and I lope alongside the sled easily, lightly, pushing gently to help the dogs. My rhythm, my movement is the same as the dogs. We have the same flow across the tundra, and I know then we will finish. We could run forever into the wind, across the short grass, run for all the time there has ever been, and all the time there will be, and I know it, and the dogs know it. We come out to the coast at an Eskimo village, and one of the villagers, an old man, takes me in for the night and feeds me with great gentleness and talks to me while I sit in his small house. When my eyes close and won't open, he shows me a bed he has prepared for me. As I go to sleep, I see him walk by wearing only long underwear, and he looks the same as the man who saved me in the burn and earlier when I was sick. He has the same curved, strong shoulders and quiet, soft strength. When I awaken some hours later and check the dogs and get ready for the run up the coast, he comes out to wish me well. We run out of the village north with the sun coming up on our right, heading north again, the only direction, and it is the end of day 12. Day 13. There is something about the ocean that affects me. It is open offshore, not frozen, and blue from the sky, and though it's about 20 below, it is soft cold and the dogs are full of it. They won't stop to rest. Keep hitting the harnesses. One female named Blue starts shredding her harness with great glee as a joke each time I stop to feed or rest if I don't get her the food fast enough. I'm sitting in the fourth of the last checkpoint when the race ends. We still have 200 or so miles to go, across part of the ice on Norton Sound, and it is completely over. They're having their banquets and the winner is being paid, and there is cheering and I still have 4 days to go to finish. And we do not care. We run the hills easily. Letting the team do as they wish, I simply stand on the back or push up the hills and do not care about winning or losing. Only the dance counts. The beauty is, as through the whole race, staggering. The hills which would once have put me off with their steepness are full of light and game. Clouds of ptarmigan rise like giant white snowflakes in the bright sun in front of the dogs, sometimes 200-300 of them, and the strange Arctic hares that stand on their back legs to see better are all over the place. They seem to be people, especially in twilight as evening comes and the edges of hallucinations start. I keep thinking there are people standing in back of the bushes to watch us pass. Finally, the dogs can stand it no longer, and they take off from the trail chasing one of the hares, and I get a thrilling ride down a long hill. The hare easily outdistances the dogs, and they wheel back up the hill in a single sweeping circle. They do not care that they failed to catch him. The dogs fairly hum with energy as we slide gleefully down the long final hills into the checkpoint just before we go out on the ice, and it is the end of day 13. Day 14. From Shaktulik we must cross Norton Sound. Depending on who is telling you, it is apparently about 60 miles of sea ice. Horror stories abound about the sound. Rumors. Somebody has gone through the ice and they found her team wandering alone. Somebody else went insane and is making big circles out on the ice, but nobody wants to stop him because he will be disqualified if he is given help. Somebody was found dead on her sled. Somebody was torn from his sled by the wind and the dogs blew 30 miles across the ice sideways and he didn't find them for 2 days. Somebody was on a large cake of ice and it broke loose and headed out to sea. They are worried that she will not be found or may drift across the Bering Sea to Russia. Somebody froze his eyeballs because he didn't blink enough and is blind but is finishing the race anyway. Somebody froze his nose and it will have to be amputated. All the rumors are virtually unfounded, but they rip through the area as they did at Rainy Pass, and I leave the checkpoint at dawn to head across the ice with some doubt. It is the end of day 14. Day 15. The ice gives us a joy run. The wind abates, the sun comes out, the trail across is flat, frozen seawater, and the dogs are well rested. We fly. I let them lope easily in a gentle canter for close to 40 miles before they come down into a trot, and when we stop to rest, several of the dogs actually start playing like puppies, crouching down and bouncing around towards each other. The day passes in a kind of Gidget-goes-to-Gnome happiness, and when darkness comes, I see the lights of the checkpoint across the flat ice, and the dogs do as well, and they start running towards them in the same easy lope. Distances are very deceiving out on the ice, however, and we still probably have 30 or 40 miles to go. In a while, it seems as if the lights will never get closer, and the dogs break down in a fast trot that carries them all the way in. As we enter the village, a small boy leaps out of the darkness and grabs the leaders by the back of their harnesses to lead them up to his house where I will spend the checkpoint time. It is a nice gesture, but the dogs pile up on themselves, get tangled, and turn inward. I'm terrified they will begin fighting with the boy in the middle. Children and even adults have died this way. And I run up to him and grab him by the back of his jacket and hold him up away from the dogs and ask him why he grabbed my team. He smiles and says it is because he wants the team to stay at his house so he can learn about the dogs and sleds, and I am stunned that an Eskimo boy on the Bering Sea would have to ask someone from Minnesota about dogs. I stay in his house, and his family feeds me, and they treat me with the same gentle courtesy that the older man showed me earlier. I try to speak of the dogs, but find that I cannot speak well, can only talk in grunts and single words, and have some trouble being with people. After a time, I go back out with the dogs and sleep with them on the ice. I awaken at dawn, just as the team pulls in. They look good and fresh for just coming across the ice, and I'm surprised to see the musher run forward with a little rubber duck and roll in the snow with his dog, squeezing the squeaky toy for them and playing with them. They love the game, and he keeps hiding the toy from them, and they try to get it away from him. Then he puts the duck away and dresses them in doggy sweaters so they can sleep warm, and I leave the checkpoint in a kind of gladness that I had seen him, a gladness that I knew dogs and they knew me and that we had come together. And it is the end of day 15. Days 16 and 17. Two more checkpoints. We run along the coast, along the edge of ice with towering cliffs going up to our right. The ocean is breaking away the ice, and finally there's nothing except water in front, so we angle up into the country, across a mountain, dead over the top of it, and down across another bay on ice. Here the wind is strong and blowing straight from the rear. The ice is sheer, flat, absolutely slick, and the wind blowing from the rear makes my body act as a sail. The sled blows forward and sideways, and I must ride the brake to keep from running up on the dogs all across the bay. The dogs seem to smell Nome now. They have changed, and nowhere near the end, and when we leave the last checkpoint but one and head out onto the beach, a 40-mile-long beach ending in Nome, they seem to have new purpose in their steps. It is perhaps all in my head, but then so much else is that it doesn't matter. We run through the day along the edge of the beach, running on the ice itself because the wind has blown all the snow off the beach sand. As dark comes, I can see the lights of the finish of Nome, 20 or more miles ahead, and when I realize what they are, I stop the team. I do not want to go in and finish the race. I do not understand why, but I do not want to go in. I actually begin to walk up and take my leader and turn the dogs around and run back, back. There is no sense to it, but somehow it is because the race is something that doesn't seem like it can be done. Not really. You can talk about it and plan for it and train for it, but it is not something you can do. The run. Even then, when you are making the run, it doesn't seem possible. And while you are in it and crossing the Alaska Range at Rainy Pass and running through the burn and across the interior, even when you think you are alone on the planet and then know that you are alone on the planet, even as you run out to the coast and up the coast and across Norton Sound and along the icy cliffs through all the glorious northern villages with names like Kaltag and Koyuk and Shaktuluk and Unalakleet and Elam, and even when you see the lights of Nome and think you will easily finish, even then it is not something you can do. Not something that can be done. And yet you do it, and then it becomes something you don't want to end. Ever. You want the race, the exaltation, the joy, and the beauty of it to go on and on. And so I stopped them, and thought of turning around and going back into the middle of the world, the place I had found in the center of the world, where it was only the dogs and only me, and I hung there for a time with my hand on the leader's back, and I think I would have turned them, except that I heard a yell and it was my wife. A man in Nome had brought her out on a small road in a jeep. They had seen me coming and seen me stop, and her voice broke the spell. I got on the sled again and let them run, and they followed the ice along the beach until we hit the ramp where they launch boats, and we ran up onto the front street and down the mile of bare asphalt to the arch, the finish line. Cookie, the leader, stopped before the arch, and I had to drag her beneath it to finish. She was afraid of the crowd of people. I turned and could not keep from crying as I hugged my wife and son and then the dogs, starting from front to back, hugging each dog until two mushers took them away to put them on beds, and I turned to the mayor of Nome, who was there to greet me, and said the one thing I never thought I would ever say. We'll be back to run it again. And I knew that it was true. We hope you've enjoyed this Dell production of Woodsong, produced by Blaine and DeRosa Productions. Copyright 1991, Bantam Audio Publishing. All rights reserved. Thank you.
Now, please stay with us for a preview of another Gary Paulsen story on Bantam Audio. Canyons, read by Peter Coyote.
Soon, he would be a man. Not after months or years as it had been, but in a day. In a day, Coyote Runs would be a man and take the new name which only he would know, because finally, after 14 summers, they were taking him on a raid. He had difficulty believing it, for this summer and 2 summers past he had gone time and time again to the old place, the medicine place, the ancient place in another canyon only he knew about, and prayed for manhood, all for nothing. For the whole of this summer and 2 summers past he had been ignored, thought of as still a boy, and now it was upon him. In the morning he had risen early and walked away from the camp before the fires yet smoked, and gone to the stream to rinse his mouth and take a cool drink, and nothing seemed different. He had gone to the ponies and looked at them, and thought how it would be some day to own a pony, 2 of them, many of them when he was a man, and could go on raids to take horses and a Mexican saddle with silver on it, like Magpie had done when he became a man, and who could now walk with his neck swollen. All some day. That's how he thought then, in the morning. It would all come some day. He would be an Apache warrior and ride down past the Bluebellies fort, across the dirty little river into Mexico, and prove that he was a man. Some day. After he had watched the pony herd for a time, he walked back to the huts in the early morning sun and saw that his mother was making a fire to heat a pot of stew made from a fat steer they had taken from Carnegie's ranch. The rancher had many such steers and did not mind when the village took one. Coyote Runs liked to watch his mother make fire. She was round and her face shone in the sun, and her hands were so sure when she piled the sticks and struck the white man's lucifer stick to make the fire that he thought of her as not just his mother, but the mother of the fire. As she was the mother of the stew and the wood and the sand and the hut and Coyote Runs, the mother of all things. Then Magpie had come out of his hut where he slept with his family, though he was a man, because he did not have his own wife yet. He saw Coyote Run sitting near his mother and came to him and squatted next to him in the dirt. "It is a fine morning," he said, which caused Coyote Runs to look at him because his voice was light and teasing. "A fine morning to be a man." Coyote Run said nothing but had a sour taste in his mouth. It was not like Magpie to make fun of him or to be proud so that it showed in the teasing voice. "I have heard stories," Magpie said. And now Coyote Runs could tell that he was teasing openly, but he was smiling and his eyes were not mean. "What kind of stories?" "I have heard stories of a new raid to where the silver saddles are, a raid which will leave tomorrow, a raid which will have all the warriors on it." Coyote Runs felt it now, the small excitement that came from surprises. "All the warriors and men there are. Tell me, warrior, do you have a pony?" "I'm going?" Coyote Runs tried to keep his voice even. Magpie smiled wider and nodded. "It is thought that you could come to hold the horses and see how it is to be on a raid. Sancta said it, said you could come by name." Coyote Runs thrilled inside but tried to remain cool, not show it as was proper, for a man, as a man should act. Sancta was a scarred old man who could not be touched by arrows or bullets, who had led all the raids since Coyote Runs knew there were raids. Sancta decided who would go and who would stay, and he had decided. "I do not have a proper pony for war, but it is perhaps true that I have a friend with a pony?" He looked pointedly at Magpie. "Do I have such a friend?" Magpie nodded. "I will loan you that small brown pony with the white eye, until you can get your own." "Until I can get my own." Magpie stood. I think I will go down to the stream now and clean myself. Coyote Runs nodded, but did not stand. Inside he was ready to explode, but he remained cool. Yes, the water was good this morning. And he thought, I am to be a man. I am going on a raid, and I am to be a man. There was much to do. He must ready himself and his bow and check his arrows. He must make certain that everything was the best that it could be. I am to be a man. There was much to do.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.